Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm a small child to be mentioned at the start of this episode and then not really have any more impact throughout the entire thing, Duncan Nichol.
It's very interesting, Duncan, that that's the character and the dynamic you sort of honed in on.
I was very tempted to be like, and I'm Moses? Why is Moses in this story?
I'm actually a little flabbergasted because you're right. Moses is in this story. And it literally did not occur to me until now, 5 seconds into the start of us doing a podcast episode on it. Yeah, Moses is here. Huh.
So that will be the question we shall be answering on today's episode as we review David Gemmell's Lord of the Silver Bow, the first in his Troy trilogy. Wow, what a book.
It's hard to the main takeaway I had from this book, Duncan, is that this really feels more like less so book one in a Troy trilogy and more like book zero in a Troy duology. This is like Troy, the prequel series.
Definitely has that feel. If you're going into this first book, as we kind of were, we do a tradition every year around summertime, we read a book about the Siege of Troy. I say that. We also did Cersei one year, which is sequel territory.
It's a Troy book. It's a Troy story.
Well, this is still a Troy story, but as Geordie said, this is sort of a prequel to Troy and a very interesting take. But before we dive right in, Geordie, has there been anything else you've been reading, experiencing, and just want to share with us?
Two things. So this was all the reading I did. I didn't really get into reading anything else. I had been distracted by video games. I'm still playing Baldur's Gate. I played an obscene and out of Baldur's Gate in between this and the Dragon Rise of Pern episode. I've now started Act 2. Act 2, it really... Duncan, you start Act 2 of that game, and literally the second thing that happens is the game, like, shoves you onto the ground, picks up a sledgehammer, and just whacks you in the balls a couple of times. So I'm having a great time.
I'm glad you're enjoying it. I'm so excited that one day I too will start playing Baldur's Gate 3. I'm sort of tempted. I have Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, and when I say I have it, I mean I've owned them on like Steam and GOG for probably close to 2 decades now. Never played them. Maybe I'll give them a go. Probably very different.
I think you should play in Dunk. Based on what I've heard about your computer, you probably could run those games. This is still very, very taxing on my computer, Baldur's Gate. I've got all the resolution set very low, so you might need to do a little technical upgrade before you get it onto your laptop. But it's having a great time.
Oh, that's a write-off. I've got Xbox Series S for this.
For a moment, I was like, that's a tax write-off. And I'm like, okay, Duncan, whatever you got to tell the tax man. It does have multiplayer. So if you did download the game, we could get the whole crew together, the whole D&D crew, and play a new version of D&D where we have less creative control over it. And, you know, Baldur's Gate is there for playing Dungeons & Dragons when you don't have friends. So, you know. The other thing, Duncan, which I have been enjoying, which is fantasy adjacent, as proven by this podcast, is yesterday evening, I sat down, I was looking for something to watch. I looked at Netflix, I thought, nah. I looked at Amazon Prime, I went, nah. I went to Disney Plus, and I thought, well, I did say I'd watch it. So I watched John Carter of Mars.
Ooh, what did you think?
Pretty good. I had a good time. It wasn't exactly... I don't think I really paid 100% of my attention towards it. I don't think I was exactly on the edge of my seat. But I was like, this is a pretty good adaptation of a boring book, which we reviewed on this podcast, and you should go listen to our episode on it. But I was like, yeah, this is a simple story told well. I didn't dislike the epilogue and prologue as much as you did, Duncan.
I just felt like it was... like, I also quite like this movie, but I think it's just a classic case of like a 2-hour-and-a-bit movie that could have been just a stellar 100 minutes.
You did tell me that there was that side plot about the conspiracy on Earth was 40 minutes long. It was like 12 minutes long.
It felt like 40 to me. No, fair enough. And I'm glad you enjoyed it. Were you still, though, very happy when he finally gets to Mars?
It's Duncan, again, it's not that long. I argue it's only a tiny bit more embellished than it is in the book. And no, I wasn't excited when he got to Mars because, one, his arrest scene and the way it's edited is very funny. It's actually the funniest part in the movie, this series of scenes where they're trying to recruit John Carter back into the army, into the Union Army this time, and he keeps trying to escape, and this has this fun, snappy editing style of he makes a break for it, and then he's immediately back in his chair with a bloody nose, and he tries to escape again, and he's back in his chair again, but now in handcuffs. And also, the guy who's arresting him is Bryan Cranston, and he's doing a very fun performance.
Do you know what? I don't think I even really clocked that.
He is wearing a wig.
Maybe I need to give it another shot. Maybe I need to be a bit nicer. But I'm so positive on the film.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, I'm one for a tighter edit.
Speaking of tight edits. No. Before we get into that, Duncan, have you been enjoying anything else this week? Still slavering with anticipation about Sonya the Barbarian?
I am still very excited for the upcoming Red Sonja movie, although there's been some more kind of fantasy news in my space that got me very excited. They've recently announced from Titan Books, the guys who have the Conan license, we're getting some good stuff down the line, Geordie. They're doing the original Marvel Savage Sword of Conan. They're calling it Savage Sword Reforged. It's going to be in magazine format, and they're basically going back and they're recolouring and remastering the original works. Which is interesting. So
this is the black and white one from back in the day.
Yeah, they're adding colour to what was originally black and white comics, which I am very kind of funny about. I've seen it done well. I've seen it done very, very, very badly.
Yeah. I'm in the same camp of seeing it done well and badly. There's a genuinely quite good fan edit of the Naruto manga where they like did a colorized version of it, and it looks really good. And there are some attempts at colorization in the latter half of fans of the Naruto manga, which is awful, and it looks genuinely... There's something clean and sharp about black and white art, and often it's drawn that way deliberately. Sometimes certain choices are made when work is black and white that adding a new dimension to it is actually just going to detract from it. So, anyway... I'm obviously not going to consume that. And Duncan, you already own all of those comic books, so it's up to you, I guess, whether you want to spend your money on that.
I will probably still buy them again. You're absolutely right. That's very exciting news. They've also announced the Kindle book. So Titan's been releasing short stories of Conan the Barbarian and other Robert E. Howard characters, exclusive to Kindle for like £1.50 up to £3. They finally announced that they're going to get like an actual collected edition. And this is so exciting for me. I've always hoped they would do it. I'm so glad it's now finally happening. But other than that, Geordie, I do need to say, I also went on a bit of a spending spree. And I don't want to go into too much detail because, like, I bought about 9 books. But I was so happy. We went to, like, a little model train fair that... Don't need to go into details. That's just what my life is like. And there was, like, a marquee which was literally just called, like, bric-a-brac. And I went in there and it was, like, 3 books for £1. And, oh my god, I love rummaging through, like, stacks and stacks and stacks of books. And, Geordie, I got some amazing, well, I think amazing finds.
I'm all ears.
Right, get a load of this. I got the novelizations of the films for Dark Crystal, Spaceballs.
Okay.
The Force Awakens. And, oh gosh, there was one other one. Oh my god, I've literally bought a book. And I've forgotten what it was. I feel deep, deep shame. Maybe it'll come back to me.
I'm going to assume,
Duncan... Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Star Trek the Motion Picture of a novelization. Duncan, I know if you're much of a Star Trek guy.
I'm not. It's basically, I had 8 books and it was 3 for £1 or 50p each. Right. So it was technically free at that point.
Sure. So you were looking at the list of books in front of you and like, you know, I'm not a big Star Trek guy. I'm more of a Star Wars guy. But I guess I could pick up the novelization of the extremely boring movie, which even hardcore fans of Star Trek don't like that much.
I mean, yes, it will look fabulous on my shelf. I also picked up, funny you mentioned Star Wars, because I got absolutely Star Wars. Dirt cheap. Yes, I did. I got the Crystal Star. I got Young Jedi Knight, Heir to the Jedi. I got Cloak of Deception. I think that's actually it. I've listed them now. Brilliant. Like, I was so happy. Like, these books would cost you like £6 on eBay, and I'm there getting them for 30p. Absolute bargain. I also got, finally, segueing back in. Oh, well, actually, no, one swift tangent. Michael Morpurgo's Arthur, High King of Britain. I remember reading it as a kid. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll enjoy it again. It's a very condensed version of King Arthur, but I think there's some credit to that. A very condensed or kid-friendly version of the story.
I agree.
Finally...
Oh my God, it really is
I got... from David Gemmell. I know, maybe I'll do a summary on our Instagram. Check out Instagram, it's just a fantasy podcast.
Duncan, posting a picture of yourself holding a big stack of books is that's how you get the numbers. That's what people love. They don't want
people
breaking down in detail books. They just like seeing pictures of people holding books.
It is such a craze, and I sort of get it. And I do have to give credit to the people who are like, that, you know, they're setting up these shots beautifully. There are the books on a marble table with a background of a beautiful waterfall, or they're holding, you know, they're going for the cozy vibe, and they're there in a big fur blanket with a fire blazing. You're like, well done, great effort. The final book I got was by David Gemmell, Druss the Legend,
uh-huh.
The first in his Druss prequel series. Druss being the main character, or one of the main characters, in Legend. The first David Gemmell book that we covered here on the podcast several years ago now, but still a solid episode.
Very good episode.
And it's very good segue because Legend was David Gemmell's first book. And the Troy Trilogy were his final books before he sadly passed away in 06. And we had a lot to say in that episode about, you know, what he did well, what he didn't do well.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it'd be really kind of interesting when we dive into this book to see where he's improved as an author, how he's developed his skills.
Yeah, these are the bookends of his career. So, Duncan, this is the sort of prequel to the Troy siege. What is it about if it's not about the siege of Troy?
Fantastic question, that one. And for a little while in this book, I wasn't sure. But it's mostly about allowing us, the reader, to get to know the characters on the Trojan side of the conflict. And that's something we haven't actually experienced yet in any of our Troy reads. We always sit in the Greek camp.
Sounds like girls.
Still mostly in the Greek camp. We're not actually within the city of Troy.
It's the women of
Troy. This is the first time where... Yeah, but they're captured and they're taken from a different city, not Troy.
The sequel to Science of Girls is called The Women of Troy. So maybe that one's a little bit more specific. Maybe you get to see Cassandra and Hecuba.
I can't wait to see those characters again. But yes, in this book, we predominantly follow the main character of Aeneas, although he goes by another name in this book, I'm going to get this wrong, Helikion?
Okay, so it's Helikion. Is the name he goes by. And just so we can get this out there, because he is an important figure in Greek and Roman mythology, it's Aeneas.
Oh my God, I said Aeneas. Aeneas.
Sure. Close enough, yeah. He's of his importance. So Duncan, actually, before we go any further, because that might be useful, as we've unpacked before, we're both fond of Greek mythology, but it's something that is a little bit more in my wheelhouse. I was a big Greek mythology nerd growing up, and what we talk about in the Troy episodes is that's sort of... I tend to be relied on for some of the mythological background info. Do you know who Aeneas is? Why he's important?
Well, I do. Sort of. And this all stems from a little strain of knowledge in me. I'm under the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Aeneas is the character, or the person, I'm not going to doubt your history, who basically survives, and then his line basically goes on to be like Romulus and Remus.
That's right, exactly. So He was invented by Virgil. Now, we should point, yes, so he's not a character of mythology. He's a fictional character. No one ever actually believed in Aeneas. He was invented by the poet Virgil in the, like, oh, I don't remember, in the Aeneid, obviously, written to sort of commemorate the ascension of Octavius Caesar. So right at the start of the Roman Empire, Virgil writes this epic poem to say, this is the origin of Rome. We are descended from the gods. Aeneas is the descendant of the goddess Aphrodite. And this is why we're important. This is why we're great. We're the successors of the greatest city in the world, Troy. We're savage and brutal, like Romulus and Remus. Yada, yada, yada. That's where the character of Aeneas comes from. And this time, our hero of the story isn't Achilles, it isn't Patroclus, it isn't Circe, it isn't Briseis, it's on the Trojan side. It's Aeneas. Although, an important side character in the story is Odysseus. He is still involved and quite different from what we know him as.
That's true, and I think let's actually kind of discuss how this book approaches the myths and the mythology and the gods and all of that, because it has a very interesting flavour to it.
Yeah, flavour is a good word.
At the start of this book, it definitely gives us this general vibe of people in this world believe in the gods, but everything that we sort of see is justifiably unrelated to them. They don't make an actual appearance.
Yeah.
You know, Ares doesn't pop in and say hello, Hermes is not ever seen. It's still just a world of people with belief, but there's no in-text evidence for the gods being real.
Right. This is sort of laid out by a motif that appears a couple of times in the book. The titular Lord of the Silver Bow is Apollo. That's who's being referred to. Apollo is obviously very important to the story of the Iliad because angering Apollo is sort of what sets up the entire conflict between Agamemnon and Achilles. That's where it all sort of goes wrong. Apollo doesn't appear in the story. Aeneid is referred to several times as the Lord of the Silver Bow. A line is being drawn between them. So instead of it being Apollo who's going to mess things up on the side of the Greeks, it's Aeneid. And the book that I compared this story to most often in my head was The Warlord Trilogy by Bernard Cornwell.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up.
I mean, it had to be mentioned. That's his version of the story of King Arthur, but he roots the story of his version of the story of King Arthur in as much actual history as he can. In the section, I'm going to grab a copy of it. Hang on. So in the back of every single one of these books, Bernard Cornwell wrote historical notes about his sources. So we're seeing, like, here I'm using I'm using De Excesidio et Conquestu Britannae. I'm using the Historia Britonum, the Historia Ecclesiastia Gentis Angelorum. So he's using ancient sources to be like, okay, I'm going to make it as close to being real as I can, and then I'm going to throw Arthur and Merlin into it, and characters believe in magic and old gods. But the magic isn't real. It's parlor tricks. It's persuasion. It's drama that makes people believe magic is real. Yes, go ahead, Duncan.
Sorry. Now, this book isn't quite that, although it does set itself up to be.
Yeah. This book is fantasy. I would call the Waller Trilogy historical fiction. This is fantasy.
And to be honest, it mostly comes down to one character. Because very early on we get scenes with Odysseus, and it's made very clear, oh, he likes to tell tall tales, and he's a showman, and he exaggerates. All his great adventures are just these sort of stories that he's made up. And I'm like, okay, that's the route we're going down, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to a point where you meet the character Cassandra, And Cassandra in the original story, if I've got this right, was basically a prophet that was cursed to always tell the truth and no one to ever believe her. And Cassandra in this story is just that. She is a prophet. She sees things she could not possibly know. It is always accurate. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. So, yeah, it is fantasy then. The prophecies are completely true.
It's like if Stephen King wrote the story of Cassandra. Like, she does have accurate visions of the future, but she's crazy. Like, she's mentally ill. She, like, got sick as a child. It messed up her brain. And it just so happened to give her psychic powers. And there's one other, like, actual prophet in the book who, like, a soothsayer who does an accurate prophecy that says, oh, you will meet this such and such person. And in that classic way of, it's supposed to be, oh, is it a coincidence? Is it this just person being very intuitive? But once you get to Cassandra, it's like, no. This is just a magical little girl. This is a fantasy story. We're safe.
And it's really interesting because it is very focused on the character Cassandra. In fact, there's another like soothsayer that Cassandra kind of calls out and is like, they never tell the right prophecies, or she always says, oh, this will come true as long as you don't anger the gods. So when it ever doesn't come true, the gods go, well, must have angered Poseidon then.
That's a classic. Oh, well. The classic Greek prophecy stuff. So what we're getting here is David Gemmell is doing a much more grounded approach to the Iliad. Gods probably aren't real. They aren't centered in the story. People believe in them to the same extent that any character might believe in God in a normal fiction book, in a non-fantastical book. And he goes one step beyond this because he's obviously made an effort, like Bernard Cornwell, to ground... Is it Cornwall or Cornwell?
Cornwell,
excuse me. Sorry,
Cornwall's
Bernie.
Cornwall's a county.
Thank you, Duncan. Yeah, that's where the book is set, I know. Anyway, much like Bernard Cornwall... That was close enough between the two to be possible. Much like Bernard Cornwell, well, he's made an effort to ground this in historical realism. To the extent that it's not even about a fight between Troy and the Greeks, it's between Troy and the Mycenaeans. They're not even called Mycenaeans. It's called Mycenae. So he's saying like, ah ha ha ha, gentle reader, I am well aware that at this point, Greece isn't really a thing. You know, ancient Greeks, when they were telling the Iliad, they were referring to their version of ancient Greece. They were talking about the early Bronze Age, not the classical era. So we're being given a much more authentic look at this historical period, supposedly. At a certain point in the story, you know, a new type of ship is invented. The Birem shows up, and it's like, oh, we have, like, decked ships for the first time. That's a big deal. That's going to play a big impact in the story. We're seeing technologies which we associate with ancient Greece being used for the very first time. It's because it's so early in history. That does conflict with the fact that the actual historical authenticity is sometimes quite bad.
It does have a few sore thumbs throughout this text. And often I'd actually say what makes it kind of more jarring is that there's a combination of genuine effort with, oh no, let's just not.
Yeah.
And you're like, I could have accepted one or the other. Like, I do not mind reading a version of Troy where they're all clearly dressed completely inappropriately, where the technology and the warfare and the swords and whatever. Like, if I was reading a Troy book and they all drew, it's the line with, and they all drew steel, I'd be like, I don't care. It's wrong, but fine.
My favourite example of this in the story is, so Aeneid is not a prince of Troy like he is in the Iliad. He's from Dardania. Now, Dardania is an ancient kingdom, which is like obscure enough for people to not really be sure where it is. People know Sparta, they know Macedonia. Where's Dardania? Well, Dardania is sort of where northern Macedonia would be today. It's next to where Thrace would be, or Thrake, as the audiobook narrator called it in this. And yeah, so you're talking like North Macedonia, you're talking like Albania. One problem, David, can I call you David? David, a really big emphasis in this book is about Aeneas as a sailor, and he's like patrolling the Mediterranean, or the Great Green, as they call it, for pirates. Dardania is a landlocked country.
No, Geordie, the capital is on the coast, with the palace on top of the cliffs overlooking the sea. How could you not know
that?
Yeah,
that's a really important plot point. So obviously, like, he's been a bit flexible with the history, or he needs to be. He's like, okay, we can just sort of say the borders of Dardania were a bit flexible back then. That may well have been true. I can't find any evidence of Dardania ever touching the coast.
That's brilliant. But it's also a really good example of someone who doesn't know a lot, say me, going, Dardania. Yeah, there, I think that's a real place. Did it have a coastline? Sure. Like, I don't know. It didn't occur to me to even question.
What I do like about this, though, in terms of David Gemmell taking a different approach to the history around the Iliad and the Trojan War, is he puts this really big emphasis on the Mediterranean as a cosmopolitan space.
That's really nice. I really like to see how not only does he talk about all these different cultures, and there are multiple thrown out within the book, and how they all relate. You know, the conflict brewing between Troy and the Mycenaeans isn't independent of the relationship with Egypt. You know, it's not independent of the relationship of those, you know, kind of further eastern areas as well. And I also really like, as you say, as a cosmopolitan place, it's the fact that that's often explicitly praised in the book. There's this whole section talking about why Troy is growing great. And they say, well, it's because it welcomes all these people and they all have different talents. So, you know, they learn the great rug weaving from them and then the master shipbuilders from there. And it's that combination that makes the greatest city.
Yeah. And it's also sort of just sort of taken as a given. It's so easy for people to forget that the Mediterranean is not a big place, the Aegean is not a big place, and there's a lot of contact between these ancient peoples. And in this story, we see Egyptians, we see Guptos, we see Babylonians, we see Palestinians, we see people from, like, they don't name it because these countries wouldn't really exist in the way we know, but beyond Babylon. So we're talking about, like, pre-Islamic Arabia. So we're talking, so we're seeing this big mixing pot of cultures. And some of the more entertaining discussions in the story are about people coming to sort of understand each other. You know, like, say Gershon, who's our Egyptian character. He's a former, so he's from land that is Egypt, but he's a Gupto, which is like a almost Egyptian. He's from Egypt. And so when he comes in, he's seeing this through a different context. And we have this exchange where he's like, doesn't understand some of the, not Greek, but almost Greek rites and their beliefs. And there's these moments of like this huge guy who is a good person, who's kind and brave and generous, does not understand why the main character cares if women like him. It's like, why would you care? I don't get it. Like, I'm heroic in every regard except for this. I don't understand your culture.
This sort of an expanded conversation, I think it's around also like slavery in that section. And even the exchange of ideas, one of the main things that comes out of that conversation is he throws something out and our main character, Aeneas, thinks it's like, well, there's something that we need to debate. And he's like, well, I wasn't actually starting a debate. I was telling you something, you know, this is what my culture is. And then it's like, yeah, but we need to get to the bottom of like the right way. And he's just like, yeah, they're just two different ways. Let's not fret over it. And that's, again, a showing of a cultural difference.
So the thing I want to hone in on next, after we talked about the historical basis for the book, the geographical basis for the book, is how it works as a, like, as a story. You know, we're only familiar with David Gemmell as the writer of Legend, a book about a siege, so appropriate for this. And that book is, the first third of that book is getting ready for the siege to happen. And then the final two thirds are just one battle. And that's awesome. This is a complete inversion of that, because the last quarter of the book is about a battle. And the first three quarters are not really about the run-up to that battle. It's more the... I was about to say it's the development of the characters, but that's not true. The characters don't really change. It's more they're being pivoted around to different places so the characters can see... They have enough data that we can then arrive at the final scene. We need to, like, get to know all the main players, so that when the battle is about to happen, we know who everyone is.
It does feel, and now we haven't really given our kind of overall thoughts on this book, it does feel very much like setup. You talked about, like, the characters, and I think you're right. It isn't about a huge amount of character development. In fact, quite a lot of the key character development is flashbacks telling us how the characters we've already met got to be those characters. It's a lot of setting up the chessboard. It really does feel like this is the, like, as we said at the beginning, the prequel to our Troy story. It's just about setting up the board, telling us who the players are, telling us why certain people don't like certain others, why certain people have a certain interests and motivations, so that later we can have the Trojan War. And talking about that climax at the end, it definitely felt to me, at least, that it came somewhat out of left field, and more so because David Gemmell went, well, I need a climax for this book, so I need to put something in here. One of the things that actually I would generally say about this book, and I don't want to be negative, because I did really enjoy my read, but I want to contrast this with Legend. Legend felt, comparatively, tight and fast-paced. This book, that kind of sense of, like, we're setting up the board, gave the first three quarters, two thirds, quite a lethargic sense. There were definitely moments of thrilling action and moments of, like, shock in our character development, but there was also just a lot of, who's this person? Oh god, something bad happened to them. Why do I care? Okay, I do care a bit, actually. Okay, moving on. And it's just a really weird contrast. It's a much bigger book than something like Legend. It's 600 pages. Does it need to be all of that? I'm not 100% sure.
It's tricky. I get the feeling that knowing that you're going to be writing a subsequent two books about the actual massive scale of the Trojan War, you're like, okay, the first book kind of needs to be of a similar length to justify itself. Maybe what we're actually experiencing is just the bloat which a lot of authors get as they get more established. This is at the very end of his career. He's written the Saga of the Draenei. He's sort of now allowed by his editors and his agents to just sort of write what he wants to. You know, he's a proved winner. And yet, I don't even want to say that, like, individual scenes are bad, because the action's pretty good, and a lot of the scenes of characters just talking are pretty good. I really like the conversational flow, especially, say, Andromache or any scene that Odysseus is in. I think these are pretty solid. There's just too many of them. I don't need to see four scenes of Andromache talking to Priam. Two would probably be enough.
I think that you really kind of hit the nail on the head there, and it almost reminds me a little bit, and I do mean a little bit, of when we read Murtagh, of you see multiple scenes effectively doing the same thing. There are multiple scenes with Andromache and, I'm going to say, Loddike?
I literally don't know what character I'm referring to.
The princess.
Right. What is her name?
I'm seeing a pronunciation online as La Odike. La Odike. daughter of Pram. Anyway, there's multiple scenes of them establishing their relationship and establishing that she has, you know, a lack of confidence and, you know, secretly in love with this character and all of this. And it just feels like we get one sort of after the other. And like, cool, I get the same point. Again, none of these scenes are bad. There just seems to be a few with no actual new tidbits of information being put forward to you, the reader.
Okay, look, so we've covered some of our issues with the way in which characters depict in this book in terms of how many times do we need to see such and such characters get into the same type of conversation. But let's actually hone in on characters, and specifically Trojan characters, because you were very right to point out, Duncan, that up till now, our lens, even in Silence of the Girls, has largely been on the Greeks. And to really hone in it, you were very right to point out to me that in the Silence of the Girls, yes, the perspective characters are Trojan, but they are perceiving the Greeks. They're still kind of, to a certain extent, the focus of the story, the instigators. This is the first time we pull back the Iron Curtain and look at Troy as a place, as somewhere where people live.
And I really like that. To be honest, early on in this book, I think there's actually quite a magical moment when our characters first arrive at Troy. And instead of just seeing it as this like closed gate and distant battlements, yeah, you see it as this vast, complex, multicultural city. And it's actually really wonderful to kind of get the sense of, oh, I now know what's lost.
Yeah, yeah, that's well put, Duncan. I like that chapter too. It's very rarely that I actually get convinced about a city's beauty when it's described in a book. That sort of thing tends to wash over me. I don't really care that much. This time I was like, you know what? I'm captivated by this place. It's going to suck when it gets destroyed.
It is, and it's nice. And it's good that we can actually see this place up close and see those characters up close. My actual favourite one to get to see was the King of Troy. King Priam? Priam?
Priam, that's right. He's got the simplest name you can imagine. Priam was interesting in this one because he's actually weirdly multifaceted. I was really surprised by the take. So Silence of the Girls has a very, very positive outlook on Priam. He's this character. There's very little that's actually like written about him. He has 50 sons and daughters. And like all of his sons are dead by the end of the Trojan War. So he's naturally this tragic character. And yet, he's also primarily the antagonist for a lot of people's take on the Trojan War. We stand behind Achilles, we stand behind Odysseus, we stand behind Diomedes as our heroes, and Priam is therefore the antagonist. Why can't Odysseus go home to Penelope? Priam won't quit. He won't give up. So in this book, our initial look at Priam, considering that we're going to be behind the Trojans, is really appalling and disgusting.
He is a morally bankrupt character. It is made very clear that he does not mind degrading people, taking advantage of his position when it comes to, well, it's made very clear, like, John, he is there to marry Hector. He's just like, if my son doesn't come back, yeah, I'm going to have you brought to my bedchamber. In fact, it's made clear, he's like, I might have you brought to my bedchamber before he gets back.
So he's this appalling, brutish character. You know, he's an actual sadist. You know, like, he enjoys seeing people hurt. Like, he has people executed for fun. He pits his many sons against each other. He delights in bringing down the conspiracies that are wrought against him. So you spend the whole book hating this guy. And then, weirdly, at a certain point, the book starts to frame it. And you're like, how come I'm kind of rooting for Priam to win? why has this happened? And this all breaks down through his interactions with Andromache, where at first he's purely antagonistic. He's a creep. He's an actual, like, sexual menace to her. And then at a certain point, the book says, now, what are his principles? What does he believe in? And what we come to realize is that the reason why he's okay with, like, subjugating people, why he's okay with pitching people against each other, is his whole philosophy is about people, I'm in charge, I'm the king, people should serve me. And what you find out is that when people stand behind him, he's very loyal to them. So there's this contradiction emotionally between you expect this guy to feel entitled to people's worship, to their reverence, to their loyalty. But actually, he's a character who doesn't take it for granted, and he rewards it when he sees it. So when he finds out that he's punished someone for something they didn't actually do wrong, he actually feels bad about it, which is like the base level of human morality. But that was a real step up for him at that point of the story. And at the end, when Argosius shows up and is like, I'm fighting for you despite the fact I'm fighting against my own countrymen because it's the right thing to do. He's like, I will give you literally anything you want because I respect what you've stood up for.
It's really nice. I say really nice. No, it is. It's nice to kind of like fill out this character and make him truly multifaceted. Like you said, it's that I punish, you know, he's a king, but that means he needs a firm hand. And I actually think when you're looking at sort of these sorts of characters within this sort of historical context, that kind of firm hand approach richly rewards those that serve him, harshly punish those that rise up against him. I mean, it's what creates stability. You know, his people are flourishing under him.
Yeah, so there's this parallel being drawn to Aeneas, Helicaon, because at a certain point of the story, he's a prince throughout most of the story. He has no interest in actually wielding power any more than over his crew. At a certain point, he has no choice. His family is killed. He must step up and into the throne which he previously abdicated. And the first thing he does is what you're supposed to do in your first day in prison. The moment one person steps out of line, he kills them on the spot. And he's doing this because in every other regard, he's this extremely fair, very intelligent, very thoughtful, very sensitive character. But he knows the first thing I have to do is murder someone in front of these people so they know that I'm serious business. And this book is sort of putting its foot down on the nature of pre-democratic power. You know, it all flows out of not the barrel of a gun, it flows out of the ability to get people to murder for you.
I mean, that is, no, I say one way to look at it, that is like the key kind of concept here. Like, power comes from the fact that you have to convince people that you are in power and they should do what you say. And I really like it, particularly with Aeneas as a character, because he's kind of like doesn't want to do it. And afterwards, you can tell he's like, gosh, I almost wish I didn't have to do that, but that's what you got to do. I've got to show these people I'm serious. It's unfortunate, but there's no other way. That's how you run a country. And now less people ultimately are going to die because more people are going to toe the line.
So a lot of the fun which is had in this book is about big, strong men making hard decisions that often involve violence. How do you navigate, you know, like the world of power, the realm of power, when people are trying to kill you? You have to meter out a certain level of violence. That's the appeal of this book. It's about people who would otherwise get along very well are forced to be big, tough, and violent, kind of against their will, in the same way that, you know, Druss has to go on a roaring rampage of revenge. He didn't want to do that, but his fiance got kidnapped, so he has to do it.
And that plays out with sort of several characters. Can I actually, sorry, just because we kind of left King Priam, there's actually another little moment with him which I did really enjoy. I would love to hear your take on it. didn't you really love when he's having a conversation quite near the end of the book about him, like, rooting out the plots to him enacted by his children? And one of the kind of things he says at this point is, do you know what? If one of them was cunning enough to actually beat me and, like, usurp me, good for him. He was better than I am. And I just thought that was, like, a really almost, like, weirdly nice moment that he almost doesn't, like, resent his kids for trying to bunk
King
him off.
Priam, Dark Lord of the Sith.
Full on, he's got that energy. You know, there can only be, I was about to say, there can only be one, that's Highlander. But he respects strength in others. And he doesn't, like, hate his children for trying to murder him. Like, in his own horrifically twisted way. And there is a scene where we follow one of his sons, and they show, you know, his son was scared of the dark, so he took him into a cave and doused the light. And it's a scene kind of showing Hector being quite a heroic. Hector comes through and, like, helps that other, right. His brother out. But the key point of that scene is that Hector's sort of saying to his brother, he's only doing that because he thinks it's how to cure your fear of the dark. Again, terrible parenting, don't do things like this. He's absolutely scarring this person for life. But in his very twisted way, he does think he's doing a good thing for his children.
Yeah, which is all what all abusive parents think. Now, thank you for bringing that up. I know we were trying to talk about Trojan characters, and we'll do that, because we are going to talk about Hector, who is in 4 pages of this book, but is in 80% of the pages if you're just talking about people talking about him. Hector is obviously one of the most important characters in the Iliad. He's a character that has a lot of mystery about him, because there's no scenes from Hector's perspective in the Iliad. He's a character who shows up, kills Patroclus, and then is killed by Achilles. That's his narrative purpose. So there's a tension in the book of, what's Hector going to be like? Is he going to be heroic? Is he going to be the Trojan Achilles? We have so far seen universally positive depictions of Hector. And this is probably his most positive depiction yet, because Hector in this book is the Aeneas of the city of Troy, not the side of Troy in the war that's going to happen. Because he is raised to power, he's a great warrior, but he's also very kind, he's generous, everyone loves him. He doesn't really need to stoop to doing awful things to remain in power, because people are automatically loyal to him. But the thing which really stands out, and which David Gemmell is going to as an example of him being one of the good guys, is something that kind of surprised me about this book, which is how much of this book is about men being nice to each other and trying to fix damage done to them by abuse through kindness. That surprised me.
I mean, it's a very pleasant surprise. But you're right, it was interesting the fact that this is a theme that gets revisited and revisited. Very early on, obviously we see, I keep wanting to just call Ennis because it's easier than what is actually called throughout the majority of the book, Helikion.
Helikaon and Aeneas.
Helikaeus. Oh my gosh, I just merged the two.
Aeneas.
We're calling them Aeneas. One of the things that we see very early on is in a flashback, and this is what I mentioned earlier about a lot of character development actually being delivered in these sort of flashbacks. How do these people become the men they are today? And we get Aeneas' relationship with Odysseus, and we get to see this really cool, quite extensive section of the maybe not of the whole book, extensive section nonetheless.
I think you mean, Duncan, is an outrageously long section.
Yes, it's
very long-winded, very slow, did not need to be written like this. Not offensively bad, but like unnecessarily long.
What I mean, yes, you nailed it. It wasn't outrageously long relative to the, like, it didn't take up a huge percentage of the book, but it was very long for what it needed to be. And this is the story of how Odysseus is brought in by Aeneas' father, and Aeneas' father is like, oh, my son, He's terrible. Ever since his mother died, he won't leave his rooms. Could you take him on your boat and murder him for me, Odysseus, so another son could take his place? And Odysseus is like, I'm not down with that. Good on, Odysseus. Nice to see our hero being heroic. And
this, great job.
This whole section of Odysseus, like, trying to get him to come out of his shell, with Odysseus pretending that he can't swim and getting Aeneas to come and rescue him, and then being like, right, you're coming away with me on my boat, I'm going to train you up to be great. It's a nice section, and this sort of thing, and it sort of pays forwards, because then Aeneas, there's a young child, Xander, thank you, who he sort of takes under his wing and sorts him out with a good place to stay and teaches him the way of the sea. And it's this kind of paying forward culture of them all being like, no, we've got to be nice because they're the ones that are going to come after us and tell our stories in a way.
Exactly. And there's this theme throughout the book of people wanting to be good people. You know, they're in a violent world. They're having to do atrocious violence a lot of the time. And they keep telling each other, like, we need to be better than our enemies. You know, we need to try and do better. And that's the thing I think really separates this from being like a historical fiction novel and makes this into a fantasy novel, because that feels like it should be, you know, in a Drenai book. The idea of the thing that's in peril is not the actual battle at hand. It's not about killing pirates. It's not about chasing the Mycenaeans out. It's about maintaining the sanctity of their souls. That's what matters to these characters. It's interesting to me that, you know, that's the decision that's being made here. It's not even like a deconstruction of masculinity. It's about David Gemmell walking this line between, I want to write cool, badass characters, and yet I can't bring myself to actually commit wholeheartedly to a pre-medieval morality code. I can't really bring myself to just make them into these, to make them obsessed with honor and following their liege lord and stuff like that. I want to write them as fantastical heroes who have moral codes and a sense of righteousness, the thing that separates them from the Greek ideal of heroism, which is being great at doing stuff, being clever, being strong. To David Gemmell, he's like, I can't bring myself to write that. They have to be nice. They have to be kind. They have to love each other.
Now, from a reader's perspective, I think you could very much take that in two ways. Some people might view that as him kind of like chickening out from this sort of commitment to this overindulged kind of masculine take. For me, it's what actually made it a kind of a heartwarming read. It's what made me like the characters. And you could argue, well, you don't need to like them. I'm like, yeah, but I'm with them for 600 pages. It would be nice if I can like them.
There's a lot of stuff which I don't really enjoy about the book. I get, as Duncan just said, it's too long. It doesn't need to be this long. It's about too much stuff when really you're just trying to set up the circumstances that are going to lead to the Trojan War. And yet, you're quite right, Duncan. The stuff that works is the fact that whenever a chapter happens and characters are just talking, it's fun. It's nice to see these characters interact. When I see them teaching Xander how to be a sailor, something which really does not go anywhere, because he is not a sailor by the end of the book. He's not a soldier by the end of the book. Nonetheless, they're enjoyable scenes. They don't feel like time wasted.
Camaraderie. That's the word. This book captures a sense of camaraderie brilliantly. And it captures it with our characters that we go through the whole book with Aeneas, Odysseus, Xander. But it also captures it in these little moments. Near the end of the book, when we're in the climax, and the climax, I don't think I've explained, is one of Priam's sons attempts a coup, and he gets some Mycan soldiers and some Thracians to basically storm the palace while they're in this sort of funeral march, because they think Hector's dead. Anyway, not relevant. But in this kind of ending fight, there are so many of those perfect little moments that you get in like an old war movie of two soldiers sort of clapping themselves in the arms and being like, brother, this be the end, I will stand by you. And it cuts between the characters that we have been with for like most of the book, and it jumps to the enemy side as well. We get little moments with some of the Mycaeans having the same sort of interaction, like, oh my god, have you heard? Their greatest warriors are in there. And they're like, I'll stand with you, don't you worry. If we go to Hades today, we'll make a great story. And it batters back and forth, you know.
It's very legend.
Very legend, isn't it? And it's what legend did so well. And I'm wondering, do I think this story is improved, or am I happy that this just had more stuff in it? Because that's what it feels like. It doesn't necessarily feel improved. It just feels like there's more stuff.
Here is something which is improved in this book over Legend, which is not to say that it's great, but it's definitely improved, is the women.
And to be clear, we mean the writing of them as actual multidimensional characters.
Yeah, that wasn't a judgment call on the two women in David Gemmell's Legend.
But when the tally got above like 5, and they have conversations with each other about other things occasionally that aren't just men and who they like, I was like, well done, David Gemmell. You have cleared the basic bar. This has been your career building to this.
Yeah. Considering this book was written in 2005, this book actually has a surprisingly good depiction of homosexuality. You know, it's both the palatable to men who read fantasy novel lesbian relationships, but also, although I will point out, this is never on screen, it's only talked about in the abstract, because that's, again, palatable to heterosexual readers. The book is unapologetically like ancient Greeks were like, believe that bisexuality was the right way to be. There are mentions of like that people come to me like, well, obviously guys having sex is fine, so why do you have a problem with women having sex, huh? That's their big woke conversation. There's a bit in it, this is I think a great encapsulation. Odysseus talks about homosexuality and homosexual relationships, and he sort of says like, you know, I was never into it myself, and I always felt like I was missing out on something. And I really like that bit, because even though it's like, don't worry, guys, don't worry, I'm not going to make your favorite Greek hero into a queer. Oh, no. But he is okay with it.
It's genuinely, I thought, quite a refreshing approach. I didn't like begrudge David Gemmell for not going into more details or not making it more of a focus, but really recognising it, you know, particularly, what, 06, 05, the freaking Troy movie came out and was like, yeah, nope, let's get out, yeah, the erasure. Exactly. Take away any reference to homosexuality in this narrative. I really like that it's been recognised. And back to sort of the women characters that experience it and engage with it, I thought it was genuinely nice that we saw it come from multiple different perspectives. We see two characters who have both previously had a lover who have then had to come to Troy and marry for, you know, the diplomatic reasons, and the fact that they can both sit there and go, oh, you know, they share in that kind of like what they've lost to the sort of functionalities of the world.
Okay, women. So we talked a little bit about queer stuff in this book, queer readings book. It's got depictions of that. As you rightfully pointed out, Duncan, you know, this book definitely aces the Bechdel test. You know, like, there's lots of scenes of women just talking about the stuff they're interested in, the role that they play in society, but also just interpersonal stuff. It succeeds at that far, far in excess of what we saw in Legend, which was just the real dampener against that book, is the casual misogyny of that book, where women really are all prizes to be won. The like super competent female archer who shows up never does any archery. She's immediately relegated to the role of nurse and masseuse and sex object. that is a very different experience.
To be fair, we also do have a hyper-competent archer introduced.
But she does archery.
I was so scared. I know she does it. I was like, don't do it. Oh, come on, Gemmell. Show me you've learned. And when she does it, actually. In fact, at the end, where the character Cassandra, we're talking about the character of Jomica. Cassandra is like, quickly, take your bow. I'm like, oh my god, she's going to have her bow for the action scene. Oh, thank goodness.
But more to the point.
So, big thumbs up.
Strong female characters is not about whether they can shoot a bow real good, whether they can swing a sword real hard. It's about whether they are as complex as the male characters in the story. And I think there's definitely the case in this. Andromache is definitely, like, as significant a main character as the actual hero, Aeneas. Andromache, obviously, in mythology, is the wife of Hector. And that sort of... she plays Hector's betrothed in this book. So a lot of the frustration she's having is about the classic stuff. Princess doesn't want to marry for political reasons. She feels constrained by the role she plays in society, and that's a good portion of the drama in the book.
Well, I think it works really well though with that kind of issue of, you know, her brushing up against her role in society, is the fact that it's not just a cut and dry, you know, she needs to break free, she needs to do something her own way. There's actually, I think, a really good message, which parallels as the messages that Aeneas is sort of learning as well, is the fact that this is the society. The society is unfair, and there is a role, they have this sense of duty, you know, they have to do certain things they don't want to, but it's finding the power within that and what they can do to make themselves happy. Sort of within the society that they, you know, have to function within. It's definitely a case as well of, you know, this isn't an equal society, but unlike, say, the sort of casual misogyny in Legend, I think the author is doing a good job of portraying a misogynistic society, but obviously not endorsing it and not having our main characters sort of without someone commenting, acting in certain ways. You know, it's recognized, it's looked at, it's gone, oh look, this is a thing, misogyny is a thing, let me as an author explore and analyze it.
Right, what should we point out though is that the message is one thing, and I've said this before, you know, a book's message is rarely what its actual substance is, because you can have a work which is supposedly feminist. Take, say, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Right on the tin, it feels very feministy, it's very girl power focused. But actually, when you peel back the layers behind the show, it has a lot of misogynistic qualities to it, actually, if you dig down. Not to say that it's fundamentally bad, it just has a lot of poisoned pills that come along with it. That is often the case in an author will insert their own personal biases. Like, for example, a book can have a feisty female lead, but the work can still be kind of misogynistic if she's relegated behind the other characters. Take, for example, our favourite punching bag on this podcast, Malice. That's a book which, much like this one, has important, politically important female characters who actually don't get to do anything. My favourite scene in that whole book is where a 14-year-old boy and his older sister are confronted by a criminal, and the boy, like, negotiates essentially a hostage situation with this criminal, and his older sister says nothing. That's not what's taking place in this book. That unconscious bias which infected Legend has obviously been expunged at this point.
So, well done, David Gemmell.
Well done, David Gemmell. And maybe well done, Mrs. Gemmell. That might have had a role in this one. We do know that she was part of the creative process for the series, at least, because she had to finish the books. He died before the publication of the end of his trilogy, and she had to be the one to put it out.
It's maybe a balance we can't really know simply as readers. what the kind of creative input is, but it just kind of made me go, how do I put this? Like, well done. I was so worried that, like, we wouldn't see those things sort of work their way out through David Gilmour's work. And I'd be very interested to maybe one day, in the far future, having read a lot more of David Gilmour's work, maybe see his, is it like a casual development? Or maybe Legend was just the first one where he's, you know, got feedback on, oops, made some mistakes there. And maybe he corrects it right away. I don't know. I haven't read sort of the expanded Dresnier just yet.
Now, we've gone quite hard in saying good job, David, if only because the main problem with his other book, which we otherwise really liked, was the misogyny. Let's talk about, I wouldn't say it's a slam dunk. So we got to talk about the depiction of sexual violence in this book. So this book falls into a category of depictions of sexual violence in fantasy, which I'm surprised we haven't actually seen that often on this podcast. Partly because we have avoided ones I think we know are going to be bad for it. When I think about sexual violence in the fantasy genre, I'm invariably thinking of things along the lines of Game of Thrones. You know, Game of Thrones is a book where it's like unequivocally, it's like, oh, this is bad stuff. We're depicting sexual violence as bad. It's not like we're condoning it, but it's all over the books. It's everywhere. And there's a conversation to be had about, well, is the inclusion of it at all included for the sake of drama? Is that problematic? And I think the answer definitely skews towards yes, especially when it's in the voluminous amounts that's depicted in, say, Game of Thrones, but also because the popularity of stuff like Game of Thrones means that that idea gets propagated outwards. So you have Game of Thrones, and then you have Prince of Thorns, which has like one of the most disgusting depictions of sexual violence in any book that was so repugnant that it put me off Mark Lawrence for years, and I had to be press ganged into reading even one of his books.
And I think it's very important to kind of bring up, it's not about the inclusion. It's about how its inclusion is depicted, how it influences the narrative, and how it is kind of handled by the author. And at some point also, it's almost you want to get, what's the authorial intent here? You know, is it meant to just make me go, oh my god, like shock and horror, as may be seen in a Berserk, for example? Whereas, and also, does it dehumanize and take away from the actual characters that are experiencing it? Are they shuffled to the sidelines? I think that's quite often an issue where it's not ever focused on the people being represented who are actually experiencing this. So where does the Troy books kind of fall on this? Now, Geordie, from my take on it, I actually was slightly more reminded of actually Werner Cornwell in another way in his Saxon stories, because a lot of it is spoken about. It happens off page, but also a lot of characters are threatened by it. And although our heroes would never, ever, ever, there are certainly characters who are on the, you know, the air quotes coming in here, good side, who, you know, we know have committed it or are very nonchalant about it. Am I happy it wasn't focal point on page and actually described to me? Absolutely. However, there are definitely some characters who experience it, namely Ennis's, I don't know how to describe her, mother-in-law turned wife?
Stepmother, later wife,
who, and I feel really bad for even forgetting this character's name. It's like, I want to say it's like Helia. You know, they go through something, and there is a scene, you know, it's not brushed over. But is it getting the full depth that I think it could have? No. I think, you know, there's a little bit more that could have gone into this dialogue, and it's often used as sort of just this shorthand, really, really bad thing that the bad guys do.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of treated in a way that, like, okay, bad guys have attacked a place, so invariably this is a consequence of that happening, because these are, you know, evil soldiers. Okay, yeah, that does check out. That is a thing that happens in history, and a big clause people use when talking about inclusion of sexual violence in fantasy novels is historical accuracy. That being said, when we're talking about why does this exist in the story, is it for the sake of historical accuracy? Yeah, that probably is in David Gemmell's mind. Is that a good reason to include it? I would argue no, because as you rightly pointed out, there are ways in which to depict it happening, gesturing at it. Joe Abercrombie is unusually good at this, because he's good at gesturing at the idea that this has happened without having it being put directly on the screen or the page. Soon to be the screen. Apparently the Devils is going to be adapted.
Interesting pick, but good for him.
But, is it for historical accuracy? Probably. What's the real reason? Well, the real reason is so that the main female character can be menaced. You know, Priam is set up as her antagonist because he's threatening her with rape. And it's to motivate the main male character, because it is his stepmother turned future wife who is raped by pirates. And this happens, plot-wise, this happens so that Diomedes, an important character in the Iliad, is killed off-screen. That's the king of Dardania. Now his big brother, Aeneas, has to take over, and he's compelled to become a king. And then he hunts down the pirates in short order and brutally kills them. So it's fridging. You know, it's harming a female character to motivate the main male character. And fridging is one of those truly casually misogynistic things that we were talking about before. We were talking about how this is actually pretty good at not doing that, but this is the way in which it completely fumbles, because fridging is extraordinarily commonplace in fiction. And it really comes from a deep-rooted smog of misogyny, that female characters exist in the service of male characters. And this book has a lot of pretty good female characters, but this is a classic blunder which he stumbles straight into.
It is, and it's this idea that then, you know, their experience isn't as important as the secondary experience of the male character for their motivation. I will, like I said, there is a small scene, there is the tidbit of David Gemmell sort of having a conversation about this with between both characters, but it's not really there. It's not the worst fridging incident in the history of literature, but it's still not quite what I would want to see. It's one of those things I would have to say, Geordie. Like, it's one of those things, like, you know, in another universe where we got more years with David Gemmell, I feel like he's working in the right direction. I feel like, you know, a couple more books time, he would get to the point where he'd absolutely nail it. And it's unfortunate, with such a big book, with so much going right, I almost just want to be like, you just didn't need this in its entirety.
I mean, the answer to that is definitely no. He would not get better at it in a couple of books' time, because he only had a couple of books left, and those books, you know, the Iliad centers around rape. Rape is like the engine which makes that story happen, because it's all about the abduction of Briseis, and then what happens in the sacking of Rome. Well, what happens to, you know, I was supposed to say Archimedes. What happens to Andromache? You know, bad stuff. That's why the Silence of the Girls exists. That's why Kirke exists. That's why people feel like they need to have feminist readings of the Iliad, because it centers around, you know, it's a book about fridging in its own way. Patroclus gets fridged.
I mean, I can't disagree with that, and that's why it's become such a popular way to sort of reframe the narratives. In fact, when we were doing, say, like Song of Achilles, I think one of the main messages there is the fact that all these men were just looking for a reason to go and do the fighting. You know, it's not about that other experience. Now, and a lot of people are going to say, guys, you picked this book knowing it was going to be the more hyper-masculine kind of warrior take on
it. Actually fell short of that expectation. It was much more sensitive, and it was much more soft and light, and I use this word completely unironically, much more woke than I expected.
Yes, it is. And this is why I think it's very interesting, and why I look at this book, even this sort of issue we're discussing, with a slightly more kind of softer kind of take to it, rather than maybe how I felt when we read Legend. Simply because I can really get the sense that David Gemmell is trying. He is thinking, he is trying to... He's doing his best. He's failed in a point quite badly, but I feel like David Gemmell's heart is in the right place. Particularly around his female characters, between his male characters, and particularly on his approach to like homosexuality in the work as well. The effort's there.
That's true. Much like Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
But all that said then, Geordie, do we recommend this book? Because I think we've been very mixed, and maybe more mixed in discussing it than I felt reading it.
I mean, I don't know, Duncan. It is mixed. It's a very mixed book, because it has a sort of, like, it's passively good. You know, reading, you know, some chapters, you're like, yeah, this is a pretty good time. But you know what I never did? I never, like, punched the air. I never went like, yes! Oh yeah! Now we're cooking! That's right, we're gonna take part of this archery competition. Oh yeah, you be nice to your servant! Arr! That never happened. At the end, it's sort of half-heartedly when, like, the, like, false Siege of Troy begins. There's some of that. But it doesn't even come close to the excitement and cool factor that we expected out of David Gemmell from what we've read of him before.
I'll say I full-heartedly agree. Thing is, I think I do. It is passively an enjoyable read, and I would say, when sort of looking at this book, I see an author who has developed, who's trying to build a grander epic, and I definitely have the feeling that subsequent books in this series probably would give me more than this first one does. This is a book one syndrome. You know, we're not at the climax yet. We can't have those really big moments. But I'm sorry, it's just too many pages to not ask a bit more of it.
In terms of reading ahead, this is the sort of thing where I would need to really carefully, and in fact, I will do this. I'm going to very carefully read through people's reviews of the next book, because what I need to know is it going to deliver? Like, could it be that the Siege of Troy only takes place in the third book of the series? If that is the case, there's no way in hell I'd read the next book. If the next book is more of the slow, prodding approach to the Siege of Troy, that would be inexcusable. The war needs to begin at the halfway point of the next book. If that's not the case, I would never read it. I would be like, you can't take up any more of my time. That's unacceptable.
I would like to, as we kind of finish off then, knuckle down on what I did kind of like and what I do have to praise it for. It was nice seeing these characters that in other works about Troy that we have read don't get as much limelight. I'm not going to lie, I think this depiction of King Priam probably will stick with me. This will be kind of the character that I'm going to imagine up on the battlements if we do another Troy story based in the Greek camp. And maybe. I would generally say, in terms of recommendations, I really have to harken back to our Warlord trilogy mentioned near the start. I'm not saying this is as good as the Warlord trilogy, at least based on this book. Compared to the Winter King, I want to say the first book in the Warlord trilogy is.
Correct.
Now, but, if you're someone who the mere idea of taking that approach to the Siege of Troy excites you, and you're the type of person who, let's be honest, reads quite a lot of big books all the time, you know you're going to get through it, page count, it's not like this is going to be a 6-month read for you, then I think there is stuff here to be enjoyed. Whether or not it should be your first introduction to David Gemmell. I'm still not quite sure, but certainly if you're a fan of the author and you've read his other stuff, this isn't bad. It's just not, and particularly, again, highlight, this first book, Lord of the Silver Bow, just wasn't great. It was good, but not where I was hoping it to be. Not on that premise.
I'm going to say this. I have to say two more things about this book. These are big, important, and impactful things. This book didn't quite speak to me because at a certain point of the story, the character Diomedes shows up. A character who I think, so far in our reading of Troy stories, has been a bit underserved. He was depicted very nastily in... was it Song of Achilles or was it Silence of the Girls? Probably Silence of the Girls, because they're all awful in that one. But Diomedes is a strange character because he shares his name with two different characters in the Greek canon. There's a guy who owns flesh-eating horses, and there's a Trojan, a hero of the Trojan War on the Greek side. The one in the Trojan War is a total badass. He fights and defeats Ares in the field of battle. So when he's like a little kid in this book, and he does like horses, so I'm like, I guess he's a flesh-eating horse Diomedes. And then he dies off-screen to motivate the main character. That's when I'm like, you didn't speak to me. That didn't speak to me. And there was one other thing that really could have saved this book, where it let me down. You know, one of the main characters is an archer. And every time she, you know, puts an arrow on her bow, she notches an arrow.
Yeah.
It's not notch. You do not notch an arrow. You knock an arrow. Fantasy authors. Anyway, 0 out of 10. F-, terrible book.
Can I just get this straight? Do you knock an arrow into its notch?
Yeah, there's no notch. There's no notch. Don't. It's a knocking point. It's called a knocking point. And it's spelled with an N, not a K.
I love this.
A notch is a bit missing from a piece of metal. You know, if you dent a hammer, oh no, I notched my hammer.
Well, I'm glad you can take that to heart. People, if that bothers you, don't read this book. But what are we going to be reading in the future?
But Duncan, I have no idea. I truly have no idea. You see, it's not my turn to figure out what we read next. That's on you. That's on you, Duncan.
It is on me, Georgie, and I was thinking. Now, this was quite a big one. This was a heavy book. So I figured we could do something a little bit lighter, a little bit more easy breezy. And I was going between all short books, maybe a short novel, and then I just went, do you know what we haven't actually ever done? Something that we've avoided.
Yep.
We've never done a flipping comic book. A sword and sorcery fantasy comic book.
Have we? We've done Berserk like 4 times.
That's a manga. It's different.
It's not this different.
This is from a Western publisher. And Jordy, do you know what's been on my mind the last couple of weeks? Do you know what fantasy character has a film adaptation coming out?
Yeah.
People, we will be doing Red Sonja. To be precise, and I have thought long and hard about this, we're going to be doing Red Sonja Volume 2, Queen of Plagues by Gail Simone.
Are you allowed to start at Volume 2?
So it's not Volume 2 in the run. It's actually Red Sonja Volume 2, Volume 1, Queen of Plagues. I'll explain in the episode. But by the book titled Red Sonja, Queen of Plagues, it is by the same author who wrote the recent novel, Red Sonja Consumed, and who is a script writer.
It's worth pointing out,
film.
You are deliberately choosing to not use the format which this podcast is based on. Did those Dritz comics like unlock something in your brain, Duncan? You were like, yeah, this is the way forward.
I merely had the moment where I realised that this was a character that I wanted to address and wanted to engage with, because they've had, I think, a fairly decent influence on sort of the fantasy zeitgeist. Lots of people recognise the character, even if they've never experienced any of their material. But at the same time, it is a character born, bred, and rooted in comics. It's like if someone came out with, like, a Berserk prose book that summarised the Golden Age arc. Like, yeah, but it's not the same. It's not Berserk. It's the same story.
There are Berserk prose novels.
Are there? I did not know that. That is actually incredible.
They are. There is one. It is considered by those who have read it to be the worst book ever written.
Okay. Once we actually finish manga Berserk, can we? Could we please?
Oh yeah. Once we've done that, we're still waiting on. Not waiting on Miura. Okay, now I'm sad again. Fine,
right,
Duncan,
everyone,
I'll read your comic book.
Join us next time for Red Sonja, Queen of Plays by Gail Simone. If you've read it, if you've enjoyed the character of Red Sonja, or more than that, if you've finished the Troy trilogy by David Gemmell, let us know your thoughts. The best place, as always, is our Instagram, Mrs. Fantasy Podcasts. It's also where you get to see additional reviews. I put one out this week for Till Death Do Us Bard. A nice little LGBTQ plus romanticy that I read previously. Another place to check out and get in contact with us is our Gmail. It's thefantasypodcast@gmail.com. We always respond to people who reach out. And who knows, maybe you get an own episode dedicated to you, as one guy did last year. He just so happened to ask me a Conan question, and I love that. Mm-hmm. And we are now on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. Oh, there they
are. Duncan,
are
we going to do a whole bonus episode about the various people behind the Red Sonja fanfiction empire?
Not as extensive, and not really a fanfic, because it's most of it has been officially licensed. But it is quite a story, and I dare say, Geordie, the opening section to our next episode is just going to be me being like, right, okay, I need to explain the detailed 30 years worth of lore in this character, and then I will give you a 30-second explanation why none of that actually matters.
Great. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
So long.
Bye. Hey, Geordie. I know we've, like, finished the episode, but we never actually talked about Moses.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So, our main, the Egyptian guy I mentioned, Grisham? John Grisham?
Gershon?
Okay. Right. So, okay. Our main Egyptian character, Gershom, he's introduced to us as a mysterious past. Turns out he's an Egyptian prince, and his brother is called Ramesses, and he's actually kind of nice to slaves. So in a sort of way, you know, you could almost argue that he does take on a bit of a